This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll revisit our conversations with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. and with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams about active shooter preparedness. We'll find out more in particular about programs that are going to be put on by, among other cities, the city of Portage soon. Also, we have another conversation for you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University, and we have another in the series of features from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg about low-income housing across Indiana, in particular, her particular area. And we'll also hear from the folks at WalletHub.com about economic matters. That and more coming up, but first the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're back with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. to talk about a very serious topic, unfortunately one that is in the news these days, dealing with active shooter and being prepared for these people. Sheriff Martinez, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. It's great to be on.
Well, in this day and age, I guess you never know what's going to happen in public. Is active shooter awareness becoming a part of our new normal, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. The days of just having officers at the schools as officer friendly or just a school resource officer has changed. Our role has now become more at security as well as a school resource officer. We live in a day and age where having drills in schools for tornadoes or fires, but now we're having drills for active shooters, and it's just the society that we live in right now.
Now, I know that lately, of course, we've been dealing with the tragedy that's happened in Lakeland, Florida. We tend to think of active shooter preparedness, I guess, mainly for schools, but I guess there also seems to be very much more of a need now in more public places like hospitals and even churches and concert venues and maybe even, unfortunately, some workplaces, too, I understand.
Absolutely. It's the same thing with active shooters. No matter if it's a school, a workplace, any venue that has a large crowd, any event that they can maximize the injuries or death when they're trying to carry out the horrific acts. So everyone is vulnerable. But when you think about it, it's the same type of training that we have to have, either for the schools, a place of employment, and for officers when they're responding.
I understand that there are certain things that just anyone should know, keep in the back of their minds. Obviously, unfortunately, we should have to think about these things these days, but it's turned out to be that way. And it's kind of easy to kind of sum them up into three categories of action of some type.
Right.
Run, hide, and fight, I guess, is a way that you can put it this way. Will you break those down and tell us what we should know in each particular category?
Absolutely. First and foremost, when you receive or when when you believe that there's an active shooter situation or there's an alarm or a code in the school and a workplace, immediately call 911.
Mm-hmm.
Assess the situation and evacuate. That should be your first reaction, is to evacuate. Get away from the school, the place of employment, or where the incident is taking place. Sometimes that can't happen. So if you cannot evacuate and there's no way to escape, then the next thing is to hide. And there's a difference between hiding. It's either concealment where you're hiding, but probably a bullet can get through where you're hiding and you can still get hit, or cover, finding a solid object that you don't think a round or a bullet can get through.
Mm-hmm.
But most importantly, when you're hiding or concealing yourself, you want to barricade yourself. Take shelter and barricade yourself in that room, because every second counts. As the first shot is shot, 911 is placed. Then the officers are being dispatched. Then officers are responding. Buy yourself as much time as you can by barricading yourself in, because every second counts. And the longer you can barricade yourself and stay safe until police arrive, that's the best thing. And lastly, it's between life and death. You're going to have to take action if that time comes. You're going to have to fight to survive,
mm-hmm.
and that's the reality. And sometimes it'll take a group effort or just by yourself or knowing when the shots are not being fired and they're reloading, grabbing any object in the room to defend yourself as you're hiding or concealing yourself, those are the best things you need to know.
I guess when we get to this point, after the incident has happened, there are some important things that anybody that happens to be involved in some type of active shooter situation should know. What are some of these things that are not only a matter of kind of after the aftermath, but also a way to keep those people who've been involved in this thing safe themselves?
Right. Well, we have to reevaluate on how these policies and procedures and drills are being done at the school. Because, as we know, some of these active shooters will pull the fire alarm and wait as the students and teachers are coming out into the hallway to evacuate the schools. So we've been proactive. We had active shooter last week that was already set before any of the shootings, and mm-hmm. Had meetings with a lot of the chief of police throughout the Lake County to come out with the county protocol. But we've been training just as officers going into the schools to neutralize a threat. What we need to start doing is training with faculty, teachers together, with school resource officers, and fire department as well, and reassess how to respond and react and to assess when the fire alarm is pulled. When you look at it, in the last 50 years, I don't believe there's been a student that has been killed in a school fire, yet we invest a lot of money into fire alarm sprinkler systems, fire retardant walls. I think we need to start investing a lot more money into the security of our children. We do have school resource officers in our jurisdiction, but not in all the schools.
Right.
So that's another thing that we need to look at. But for now, it's on the schools that we don't have school resource officers in, is beefing up patrols, putting the responsibilities of the patrol officers to do patrol checks at those schools during their shift. Do a walk, not just outside perimeter, but do a walk around inside the schools that's within their jurisdictions until we can get enough officers there into the schools. Mm-hmm. And pretty much trained with them, with the students, with the faculty, with the teachers, and that way they understand that when police officers are arriving, we're not going to stop to help the injured or answer any questions. We're going to proceed to the area where shots were last heard and respond quickly to neutralize the threat, and including lethal force. So that way everyone understands our response and what we expect of the teachers and the students.
We're talking with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. about the concerns and the preparedness for active shooter incidents, if they should happen to come. You talked a little bit here about the fact that officers obviously are going to still be focused in on making sure that that the incident is over with one way or the other. And obviously, I guess the nice thing is, too, because all of this is going to happen at the same time. You're going to have emergency medical teams coming in to help people out if they happen to be wounded. And that's going to be one thing, too. So officers don't have to worry, as you say, don't have to worry about that.
Right.
They can focus in on what they're supposed to be doing. And anybody who unfortunately has been involved in an active shooter incident will still know that the medical aid's there and they're going to be taken care of.
Absolutely. And the people need to know, as we're coming in, they need to remain calm and quiet. Avoid trying to asking questions or directions. Just follow the instructions of the law enforcement officers coming into the building, and to place, their hands in the air, their fingers spread, have their hands empty, visible at all times. Don't make any sudden moves or screaming. Just follow the commands of the officers as you're evacuating, because our primary responses to neutralize the threat. And another thing is, we have to get high tech. I know a lot of the schools have camera systems. We need to have a policy and a program where we can start monitoring a lot of the schools' cameras, so as officers are responding, dispatch can see where the suspect is at. We can tap into those camera systems and get a live feed of what's going on as we're responding, so the officers and dispatch know exactly where the threat is at.
You talked earlier here about the importance of getting with organizations, whether they're school groups, their school districts or officials, they're maybe with other organizations out there or with businesses and the like. Is it important for even family members to make a plan to be able to deal with active shooter situations?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it's something that even the parents should be talking with their children. I can tell you right now, in March, we're going to have training with the churches, a place of worship. Mm-hmm. We're going to have our active shooters experts there. We have several churches throughout the county. I believe it's March 20th and the 22nd that we're going to do training for the place of worship. It's train the trainer, the priests and the leaders and pastors of the church to also train their parishioners, their followers, and come up with a plan which will show them of safe zones, how to respond and how to react with an active shooter, because an active shooter is different. It can deal with a disgruntled employee. It can deal with mental illness. It can deal with just pure hatred. So the possibilities of an active shooter in a place of worship we've seen already.
Right.
And we must be prepared across the board, place of employment and school as well.
And we know, too, that places even like the Lake County Government Center is very well prepared for this. They have drills, I guess, on a regular basis, and they have the procedures all set up, aside from the Sheriff's Department, to the other offices, though, that if there are any problems that happen to occur, that people in the building know what to do.
Exactly. And we have the technology that the employees here will receive a message to their phone. All our court security officers, along with our police officers, are trained in active shooter situations to neutralize the threat. And it's about being prepared. And just the way we're prepared and trained here at our government center, we must do the same with the schools. But we must train together. We must come up with the plan and policy together, because we have to address the source. It all starts there at the school. Mm-hmm. By the time we're responding, shots are being fired and potential lives are being taken. So we must start there with the school, with the teachers, with the students, and train together, because we know what we're going to do and train once we get there. But we need to minimize the injuries there when it first starts off there at the schools or place of employment.
Well, thank you very much, Sheriff, for your help in explaining things to us. And we know that it's important to be vigilant, of course, wherever we happen to be, and to be aware of ourselves and surroundings at the time, and also to them. And these situations will come up, unfortunately, but if we know what to do, we're not going to panic, and we're going to let the authorities take care of things, and we'll all be better off, I suppose, in the long run.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez, Jr. We're continuing with our conversation concerning active shooter preparedness here in Northwest Indiana. We've already chatted with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez about it. Now let's turn to Portage Police Chief Troy Williams. There is a very special project that he and his department have coming up here very soon, dealing with the issue of active shooter, and he's joining us on the program today. Thanks for being with us, Chief.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Chris.
Well, we know that it seems like in this day and age you just can't know exactly what's going to happen in public. Is active shooter preparedness becoming a bit more of what you think might be our new normal?
You know, unfortunately, I think it is. You know, obviously, given the events that happened in Parkland, Florida, very tragic. You know, very next morning, we had reports of two adults carrying guns near one of our middle schools. Mm-hmm. Took us a little while to find them. There's some dense fog that morning, and so we had some schools go on a lockout. Just as a precaution. But once we located them, and there were BB guns, but they looked real as could be. And just given, you know, unfortunately, the world we live in today, you can't be too cautious on something like this.
With the situation being as it is, and like you say, you've had this one scare, basically, that happened mm-hmm. right after the shooting there to your department. There have been other departments here in Northwest Indiana that have had similar scares as well, too, about the same time, I understand. How should we respond when there is an active shooter in our vicinity?
Well, each, you know, school districts or, you know, I would imagine most businesses for that matter, if you look nationally, I mean, stuff like this, they've happened at a concert venue, a movie theater, on a baseball field.
Right.
So understanding the protocols on the safety plans of where you work, be it a school or a particular office building of some sort, knowing what the escape routes are or the exits and entrances of places, whether it's in a restaurant, you know, being aware of your surroundings, just, you know, having an idea what you would do in a given situation. You want to talk to your family, your kids, you know, if you're a teacher, the students. Just, you know, it's a conversation you need to have and you need to talk about because, unfortunately, these things are all too common.
Do you think that it's a good idea to have a family plan, certainly of this sort?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're hosting a active shooter survival workshop marketed toward, you know, school employees. We've got our own schools. We've got schools from Gary, Crown Point, Lake Station, Valpo, Chesterton, I think even Chicago. Mm-hmm. I've registered to attend. So, you know, this is to teach some basic concepts of what you probably already know, but, you know, in a stressful situation, you start to get tunnel vision and remembering to do the things that you've been trained to do, or if you've not been trained, to understand what you need to do in a given situation.
I know there's been discussion and some comment as well, too, ever since, in particular, since the Parkland, Florida situation happened, that there's been a description that there are ways to try to think ahead and deal with these things, and it's been kind of characterized in three words: run, hide, and fight. Would you kind of give us your idea of how this seems to play out?
I mean, yeah, the concept is, you know, if you have a active assailant or shooter, you want to get away from the area. You know, the schools, you know, have, you know, lockdown plans, and I mean, those are important. You know, if you run from, you know, a hallway to the outside, you know, how do you know that a shooter's not outside? So, I mean, they need to follow the school safety plans. You know, when you get to a place you want to hide, you know, we talk about cover and concealment.
Mm-hmm.
Concealment is something that can hide you, but not necessarily stop a bullet. Cover, you know, like a wall that can block a bullet. And then the fight, you know, when faced with a situation, you know, someone's coming into your classroom, your office, your business, you know, if you have no other route to escape or, you know, a way to defend yourself, what are you prepared to do? And no one will probably really know that until they find themselves in those situations. But, you know, if you've got putting a book bag in front of you would be better than not having something.
Right.
Or throwing a book, or, you know, if you have access to a fire extinguisher, or, you know, a chair blocking doors. So, I mean, there's many different things that we can talk about and we will talk about. But again, unfortunately, in today's world, these are the conversations you need to have with your family, you know, and how would you respond to something like this?
You mentioned earlier here about the importance of having such a plan, not only set up certainly for a school or a school district for that matter, but a private business or a public business for that matter. You deal with issues, for instance, in county government or local government, that something can happen there too. So you have to be prepared for those eventualities there, I would imagine.
Absolutely. This isn't confined to just, you know, schools, although they have happened a lot at schools and, you know, those receive a lot of attention by the media. But if you look around the country, you know, over the last, you know, 15 years or so, these things have happened at concert venues, in movie theaters, you know, restaurants, baseball fields with the shooting of the Republican congressman.
Right.
So, you know, you want to feel safe in your environment. One of the things to be able to feel safe in the environment is understanding how you would respond if something were to happen. So these are, I mean, it can be simply as just think in your mind, what would I do if this happened? And there's no end to what ifs. You can always play out a scenario. So if you run through these things in your mind, these scenarios, you know, over time, you know, every day, when something happens, you're going to be more apt to be able to handle it a lot better.
We're talking with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams. The Portage Police Department is going to sponsor a special two-hour-long workshop on March 13th and again on March 20th and also in April as well, too, to be able to train better the situation that police departments and individuals can run into with an active shooter situation that may come up. And I understand, too, that you're going to have, you mentioned some of the departments that are going to be involved in this as attendees. And I know that they're going to probably have some great expertise in handling things like first aid. That's always, I know, a problem. Obviously, if you do have an active shooter situation, you've got people either rushing out of the building or they're injured somehow in the building. You've got to get them the first aid that they possibly can get, as well as still probably dealing with a shooter walking through a building.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things we are going to talk about. You know, if someone's bleeding, how do you apply direct pressure? You know, is a tourniquet needed? So, I mean, obviously, we won't have doctors here, but we'll give them some basic concepts so that they can utilize and research on their own sometime to understand what you can do to assist in a situation like this.
It sounds like that you've done the best you can to be able to help prepare people if they aren't already prepared, or certainly to refresh their memory on how things are handled as well. Are you hoping that we maybe are training people for something that we hope will never, ever happen?
I'd rather train and be prepared and it never happen than have it happen and never have trained. As a side note, we've got about 140 people registered for over these four classes so far, and we still have seats available.
That's great. That's great. That's nice to know. And you can always find out more by contacting the Portage Police Department to find out about the classes and the workshops set up here. We're talking with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams about the series of workshops that he and his crew are going to be putting on here for a number of organizations here to be able to train people better prepared for any active shooter incidents that may happen here in Northwest Indiana. And Chief, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate the information.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
The term hijabi, I think, originated from within the Muslim hijabi community. Obviously, it's like combined with like the English E. I think it's just like a easy slang term. I don't think people outside of the hijabi or Muslim community are very familiar with it, that they would use it in a way that'd be like offensive at all. Like, I think I would actually be impressed if somebody was like, oh, so you're a hijabi? I'd be like, oh yeah, you know the terminology. There's actually a really distinct Muslim American culture, and it's very interesting because I think there's a lot of people who come from either the Middle East or like Southeast Asia, like these predominantly Muslim areas, who are first generation Americans like myself. Our parents raised us in a way that we identify most importantly with our Muslim religion more than with our culture. And so it's very interesting. You know how like there's like memes and like, you know, those like stuff Hispanics say, you know, like those videos that they had, like all these cultural things that arise, like we have all these Muslim ones too. And so I think that's where like hijabi comes from. I wear the hijab for multiple reasons. I think the most common one that people think is like, oh, her dad forced her, or to protect her from like the lustful gazes of man and like all this dark stuff. If I had to answer, there are several reasons. Biggest one is that I'm a Muslim woman and I believe that it's a commandment of God to dress modestly. And hijab really, it's actually even extends to your character. It's not just an external thing. When we look in the mirror, Muslims, we say, it's a prayer. It says, may God beautify my inner character and manners just as he has beautified my outer physical appearance. And so the fact of the matter is that God has created us, and like we believe that God has created us perfectly. And my concern is to focus on the inside and to make my inside beautiful. There's definitely like a rising like Muslim fashionista movement, and I love it. My mom, she wears the long dress, the jilbab. That's part of her culture where she came from in Egypt. But I grew up in America, and like I wear jeans, you know, and I want to make sure that that works. It's still modest, so I'll wear something long with it. Modesty and fashion totally can coexist. They totally can. And I think that's why these fashion designers are really, really unique. So like one thing that's really sweeping the Muslim fashion world right now is like the idea of long sleeve maxi dresses. And it's perfect because like there's maxi dresses are great. Usually they're not long sleeve though. And so like we'll have to layer. That's a big thing hijabis have to do. We have to layer things all the time. So like hoodies are great, but if you don't want to wear them with like sweatpants, like let's say I want to wear them with like regular jeans, I'd probably want it to be a little longer. So like I've seen different companies that they make long sweatshirts, or they'll make hijabi workout gear and stuff. Like, you know, it's really awesome because it's something that I can't work out on a jilbab, and I don't want to wear a jilbab because, I mean, it's perfectly modest, but it's not my style. And I love that I can have that style, like, and I can be creative with my style while also, like, observing those lines of modesty. And there definitely have been, like, tensions between the two because it's hard to, like, you know, when you're like skinny jeans are really in, but sometimes they're not always that modest, you know, or by some standards, at least some people's standards. That's the thing though, like each person is free to make their own choice and like we're all trying to do our best. It's not like it's like, oh, she's not modest, like, or like she's not up to par. Like it's not, that's not like that. It shouldn't be like that. I think it's a matter of like, you know, if you're wearing something that's really tight, that really accentuates like your curves, for example, like that's pretty hot. Like, you know, you wanna, that's the kind of thing that you wanna be wary of. So it's not a matter of like just attracting attention of like in general, because like I'm a member of society, like I'm gonna be here, I'm not gonna hide myself from people at all. I'll be in the forefront, like I have no problem with that at all. It's just a matter of I wanna be in the forefront because of something that I've done or something that I've come up with, not because of how I look. And like we obsess over these things and it can really be unhealthy that like we do care so much about our appearance and it can consume us. Like you can care so much about how you look that you're not there, that you're not like in the living in the moment, you know? When we wear the hijab, that's what we're trying to prevent. And like, that's why I'm saying hijab is not just this cloth. It's a lot more. It's a lot more on the outside and on the inside as well. It's like a whole thought process, honestly.
You can hear more original stories at Welcome Project, that's one word, .valpo.edu. This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we have next with us as our guest a fellow from East Chicago who wears many hats, not only for a living, but also, I guess, for entertainment in a way, and certainly, I guess you would maybe even say even for thrills and excitement. And he was able to share some of that with the local media as well, too. Guy Rhodes is a photographer, and he's also a lighting designer, among other things. We'll find out more in just a moment about that. But most recently, he has been working as a photographer, covering and sending back some great pictures from the recent Winter Olympics in South Korea. And we have him in the studio to find out more about this. Guy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, give us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in living here in Northwest Indiana, to be sure, but all of these different jobs that you're holding down?
Right. Well, born and raised in East Chicago, and I've always been fascinated with light. When I was a little kid at the circus, I remember paying more attention to the follow spot operators than the people in the rings. My mom has a Christmas list from that same age where I was asking for spotlights and dry ice. So whenever I question whether this is what I'm supposed to be doing, I just kind of look back on that, and I think I'm on the right track. But I've always been fascinated with light, whether it's using a camera to capture light or whether I'm using stage lighting fixtures to shoot light out at performers to tell stories that way. It all comes back to light at the end of the day for me.
What got you interested in particular on a professional level to be involved in first in photography? Then we'll get to the lighting as well.
Well, it can be traced back to seventh grade, Block Junior High School, taking pictures for the yearbook. And I think that's really where I learned that photography could be used as a storytelling tool in addition to showing people the beautiful things in the world that I notice all the time. So that continued throughout high school at East Chicago Central with David Lane and the Central Perspective newspaper. And then I went on to freelance for the Post Tribune here in Northwest Indiana. I shot heavily for them for 11 years or so. During that time, I met a good friend of mine named Mark Rabilis. He's a photographer from Phoenix, Arizona, and he introduced me to USA Today Sports Images. Got to know the editors there. They really liked my work. And when the 2010 Olympics rolled around in Vancouver, they asked if I wanted to be part of the team. I said yes, and I've been asked back for every Olympics since.
When you got involved in photojournalism on the news side, what was it that intrigued you the most about rushing out with the camera and gear and covering stories, as well as the scheduled events, like the sporting events and things like that?
I think one thing that I really enjoy about shooting spot news, that's what we call it when you go shooting a house fire or an accident or something like that. Mm-hmm. You have to think on your feet. You have to deal with the logistics of street closures and things like that and not making firefighters angry because you're standing too close. You kind of have to feel the situation out. And in a way, in those situations, there is beauty to be found too. Just last week, I shot a house fire in East Chicago, and it was 1:30 in the morning, and there's this full moon and this midnight blue sky above these barren trees, and then below that is this glowing orange house with this white smoke coming out of it. And just the contrast between those two worlds through my viewfinder was really striking. So I think that's one thing I really enjoy about shooting news like that, is that even in these situations that are inherently really bad, there is still beauty to be found in those frames.
Now, when you take it from the spot journalism that you're talking about there to the sports events and things like that, and that in turn, of course, obviously will lead into what you've done for the Winter Olympics, because this is not your first. What's the difference that you see between covering spot news and going to sporting events?
Well, with both, I think the goal is to share with the viewer a certain finite moment in time that tells the story. So if it's a high school regional basketball game and it's second overtime and there's that pivotal moment, that pivotal play, my job is to freeze that action, that moment, so people can see that play that really tells a story of what happened there. Much like at the fire or the accident scene, you might be photographing somebody being extricated from a car, and that's the moment that tells that story. So I guess at the end of the day, my job is really to decide which of those moments most effectively tells a story, and that's what I share with the viewer.
Now, before we get back to the Winter Olympics, let's talk a little about your work as a lighting designer. What got you, besides the youthful wanting to look at the follow spot at the circus, what got you interested further in getting involved in stage lighting?
Well, when I got to high school, Chester Gregory, who has since gone on to star in several Broadway productions, was my drama teacher / tech crew teacher in the auditorium. And I can remember going on the first orientation tour of the auditorium my sophomore year and seeing the lighting board and just telling Chester, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, and basically just threw it at me. And the rest is history. The interesting thing about lighting for stage, it's a lot like looking through a viewfinder of a camera. If you think about the opening of the stage, that's right. Kind of your frame. And you're using lights to basically control where people are going to look on the stage. It's a lot like pointing a camera at a scene that's before you in the world. So, again, in my brain, there's not a whole lot of difference between the stage lighting and the photography and video work that I do. It all has to do with controlling where people are going to look in the frame to best tell the story.
I was going to ask here, in respect to the fact that you do video work as well as still photography, and you just referred to that here, what is the difference to you that you found in doing lighting design for video, television for that matter, or other video work for that matter, and stage?
Well, lighting design for video is a lot more about the finite details that we can't see on the stage. When I'm doing a video interview, for instance, I will set up a light near the camera lens to just put a little highlight in somebody's eye, just to make their eye stand out. And when you're 50 feet away on a proscenium theater stage, you really can't get into that much detail. So it's kind of fun when you're doing video to be able to take the things that we do on stage with lighting and you kind of ramp them up, and you can get really, really detailed with what mm-hmm. you're doing. It's a lot of fun.
We're talking with Guy Rhodes, who is an East Chicago native. He's a resident of the city as well. He's a photographer. He's a lighting designer. And most notably, he's been among many photographers who have been able to journey to the Winter Olympics in Seoul, outside Seoul, South Korea, for the games here, then just come back here and try to work off the jet lag and all of that. I imagine first tell us about the excitement of being able to get involved in that. Once again, this is not your first Winter Olympics that you've covered, I understand.
No, this was my third Winter Olympics and my fourth Olympic Games. I did the Summer Games in Rio 2 years ago. It's always a thrill to have a front row seat to the athletes who are competing in events that they have trained their entire life for. In some ways, there's a parallel with my photography work, because I've been training most of my life to perfect my photography craft. So while I'm not an athlete, I like to think that, I kind of know what that's like. So to have a front row seat to people winning gold medals, you get the chills every time. It's a fantastic opportunity. And to be able to share those images with the world, it's the icing on the cake.
We've referred earlier to your photography work for the Post Tribune for the years, and what you still do now on occasion. In doing your sports photography work, did that help prepare you in a way for covering the Winter Olympics? It's more than just a regular sporting event.
Absolutely. The high school sports that I photographed here in Northwest Indiana, just that training that you get of how to cover a sporting event absolutely carries over to the Olympics. In fact, the Olympics, you have to be a little more, I don't want to say resourceful, but you have to take care in where you're going to set up to photograph a certain event, because unlike high school sports, the Olympics is actually a lot more restrictive of where you can stand and where you can be to photograph a certain event. So actually, in some ways, photographing high school sports is easier because you have more access. When you're at the Olympics, you can stand here and you can stand there, and that's it.
Yeah.
So you have to be very creative with those photo positions to get good backgrounds behind the subjects and to really isolate the athletes.
I suppose that would be no different than going to Wrigley Field and shooting a Cubs game, where you would only get certain shots because you have to be in certain places there, I would imagine.
Exactly, exactly. And also just knowing what shots you need to have.
Mm-hmm.
At a high school event, it's no different than shooting an NFL game, where you want to have shots of the coaches, you want to have the offense and the defense, you want to tell the whole story of the event, and that carries over really with any sport that you shoot.
All right, now let's get to South Korea now. Tell us about your prep work that you did and getting ready to make the trip to South Korea, and then when you finally arrived, you got there several days before the actual opening of the event.
Right. So my Olympics prep starts a couple days before I leave, with making sure that I have all my gear in order. And then obviously packing enough clothes to be outside in the elements for try to go 2 weeks without doing laundry, because there isn't a whole lot of time to do that there. So once you're on the ground, they give you a couple days to get the lay of the land, have some meetings with the other photographers you're going to be working with, and from there it's off to the races. I think one of the most difficult parts of this Winter Olympics for me, it was the first one that I've done where it was actually cold. In Vancouver, it rained the whole time. In Sochi, I shot cross-country skiing in a t-shirt and jeans. So this was the first one where the weather was a lot like it's been here this winter. But there's something about the cold in South Korea that's different. They call it the knife wind over there. And it cuts through you to your bone.
And I understand that was also a problem for some of the events as well, too, that had to be postponed because it was so windy for a long time.
Right. Alpine skiing was postponed a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
My venue, which was the Extreme Park, so half-pipe snowboarding and skiing, snow cross racing, slope style, those are the events that we covered. We had a slope style event that was postponed also because of the wind. The most difficult one for me was men's mogul skiing finals at night. The temperature was in the low teens with wind chills in the minus side on the Fahrenheit scale. These are the wind chills that people here have news stories about. They cancel school for. And over there it was, yeah, Olympics, let's go. And so I can remember standing up on the mogul's hill. I had hiked up to this really precariously steep position, and I couldn't feel my hands. I couldn't feel my feet. You can't go inside because you'd have to hike all the way down to get to anywhere warm. So you kind of just have to get in this zen-like state of forgetting how uncomfortable you are to do what you have to do. The cameras that I use are like holding a block of metal, which doesn't really help the cold very much. So it was tough.
Did you have any opportunities while you were there? Obviously, you're busy taking pictures, but did you have a chance to interact with any athletes?
Not so much the athletes. While I mentioned earlier that you have a front row seat, we don't really interact with the athletes directly. But again, seeing them up close, achieving their goals that they've trained so hard for, it's always a treat.
What would you say was the best event or the best events, I suppose, more than one, that you got the best pictures at that you will remember and maybe even those who actually saw your pictures in USA Today would see?
I really enjoyed aerials skiing, and that's an event where the skier comes down an incline and they hit these ramps, and the ramps are up to 70 degrees. So they're almost skiing up a straight wall, and they pop up in the air. It has to be over 50 feet in the air. And they do all these twists and turns, and they're judged based on what cool things they can do while they're flying through the air. For me, it's interesting because I get to play with being really artsy. It's one of the reasons that the editors actually ask me to go to the Olympics again and again. I often look for very abstract frames that feature graphic lines and saturated colors, and the aerials event had a lot of opportunity for that.
Do you think they gave you the best opportunity to get the best pictures actually published because it was something different than the typical sports journalistic picture?
I think so. And I think that at that event in particular, it allowed me to work really hard to find those unique frames. At the Olympics, as I mentioned, access is sometimes limited. They want to pen you in these areas, and you're standing shoulder to shoulder with 40 other photographers who are using the same camera and the same lens. That means they're getting the same picture as you. And the whole reason that I'm there is to try to find that unique frame. And with the aerials course, there was a lot of room to walk around and to try different things. So that's one thing I really liked about it.
Now that you're back from South Korea and trying to get your body back on schedule, making the flights back and all, getting rid of the jet lag, what do you get to do these days? That's obviously it's a lot different than covering the Olympics.
It is. The jet lag has been a big adjustment. South Korea is 15 hours ahead of us. So coming back here, where I'm usually a night owl, having to exist on a morning schedule here for the work that I've come right back into doing, it's been challenging. This weekend in Minneapolis, I lit a Russian wedding, which was a lot of fun, and then flew right back here yesterday to go into rehearsals for Sister Act at the Hammond Academy for Performing Arts at Morton High School.
That's great. Now, all these great pictures you've taken of the Winter Olympics in South Korea are in your camera. Some of them have been published in USA Today and other publications, I'm sure. If anybody would like to take a look at some of the ones that you feel that are the best ones that you could ever offer, how could they check them out now?
They can visit my website at guyrhodes.com. They can see my blog there that I tried to keep up with the best I could while I was in South Korea, and also on my Instagram at guy_rhodes.
And you felt it was more important to keep the blog updated than having to do laundry, I suppose, when you're over there, right?
Well, it was laundry, sleep, or blog, and that was really tough choice a lot of days, but I tried to get all three done.
Guy Rhodes, thank you for spending time with us, telling your story and telling us the stories that you got to witness firsthand through the lens of the camera, and you got to be able to send on to others here in the United States. I'm glad you spent some time with us to tell us about it, and the best of luck to you and whatever comes. It has to be less exciting, I'm sure, than the Winter Olympics, but maybe in a way it's all fulfilling, isn't it?
Everything I do is very rewarding, so you take every opportunity that you get, and you enjoy it.
Guy Rhodes, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Every housing voucher recipient finds themselves fighting to stay housed for a different reason. For one Lafayette resident, serious ongoing health issues took away her ability to be able to work for an income and to be able to create any long-term plans for herself and her children. In the second of our three-part series, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg has a profile of one single mom for whom even a small crisis can have a major impact.
Just some of them. It's not all of them.
Okay.
This is furmesoride. This like an iron pill.
And what does that do?
Help me build up red blood cell count. Because I don't make a lot of blood. I'm anemic.
In a two-bedroom apartment in Lafayette's Romney Meadows housing complex, sunlight fills a small kitchen. There are neatly stacked dishes drying next to the sink, two little boys eating bowls of cereal and blowing bubbles in their milk, and bottles of medication lined up in a row on the kitchen table.
My name is Shatamara McNeely, and I'm 25 years old, and I currently receive Section 8 voucher program.
McNeely has two sons, aged 7 and 2, and says she experienced hypertension during both of her pregnancies. But her health took a significant turn for the worse after the birth of her youngest son, leaving her unable to work.
I'm waiting on a heart transplant. It's enlarged. Like, I have a heart of a 92-year-old right now. They just said chronic congestive heart failure.
McNeely is from Chicago and moved to Lafayette at the end of 2014. When she moved into her apartment at Romney Meadows, which provides low-income housing, she wasn't living there with a housing voucher yet. Her apartment itself was subsidized. Since moving to Lafayette, McNeely has worked on and off at McDonald's and at Alorica, a telecommunications business, but she says her medical issues have largely kept her at home. After a heart episode landed her in the emergency room in June 2016, a crisis she says she's lucky to have survived, she applied for disability.
726. I'm forced to live with 726 a month.
A month?
Yes.
For everything?
Yes.
McNeely budgets carefully. She has to on $8,700 a year. Her disability payments have to cover rent, utilities, a car payment, a phone bill. She has the co-pays on her prescription medications and biweekly doctor's visits. She receives benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as food stamps, and receives health care coverage under the Healthy Indiana Plan, Indiana's version of Medicaid. If all else fails, she can make up the difference with financial assistance from her son's father's. But because of her heart, she's in a holding pattern.
I barely eat and sleep. I hardly know what a normal life is. I don't have the average life of a 25-year-old.
When McNeely applied for housing assistance, her disability helped her move up the wait list quickly, and she received her voucher in a matter of months. McNeely says Romney Meadows, which the city's mayor has singled out as a hub of crime, isn't as bad as people make it seem. She has weighed moving back to Chicago to receive medical care from her previous doctors, but she likes Lafayette. The cost of living is cheaper than in Chicago, and McNeely, who's had two family members killed there, feels she and her kids are safer in Lafayette.
The violence in Chicago was just getting worse and worse.
She's used to being a go-to person, she says, and putting money in the bank. McNeely imagines going back to school, working again, and buying a house she can leave for her sons in case something happens to her. And McNeely says even her situation might not be as bad as some, so she doesn't want to keep using her voucher forever.
I feel like it should be a time limit on stuff like this. At least I'm giving myself a time limit, because there's probably somebody out there who really need it more than me, who don't have no type of income and nothing coming in.
For now, her life is staying at home and raising her kids, because that's what her circumstances will allow.
See, I'm almost potty trained. I'm not even all the way to yet. I'm learning my colors. I know my body parts. I can count to four.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
And Emily will continue her series of reports tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking. WalletHub.com has put out a new list of cities across the country that have the worst money management skills. And let's take a look at Indiana and how things shape up here. And with us to talk about it, we have a WalletHub.com analyst, Jill Gonzalez. Jill, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, give us the methodology, how everybody at WalletHub.com had come up with the list that's out there now to see on the website.
Well, you know, we looked at a couple of different stats to really come up with this. So first of all, we know that financial literacy reflects a real growing need for instruction in U.S. households. Less than 60% of adults give their knowledge of personal finance high marks. So we wanted to see, you know, where Americans are better than others at handling their finances. So we looked at over 2,500 cities, small, medium, large, based on 10 different indicators of money management. So a lot of different credit-to-debt ratios, especially credit card, mortgage debt-to-income, car loans, student loans. We also looked at delinquencies, bankruptcies, so credit scores, all of those types of things on an individual level across these cities.
I said you had about 2,500 cities across the country that shaped up on the list, I understand.
Absolutely, yeah. We looked at not only large cities, but medium and small cities as well, because we did find so many different data points to reach from.
Now, looking through all the information and sifting it out for us here in the Hoosier State, Jill, how did Indiana cities and in particular cities like Gary and other cities of its ilk happen to turn out?
So Gary, unfortunately, out of the 2,500 plus cities we looked at, came in below 2,400. So really toward the bottom here, especially when it comes to credit card debt to income, car loans, student loans to income, all of those things, unfortunately, have really high ratios, which is not what we're looking for. It means a lot of people are kind of spending beyond their means in Gary. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, places like Carmel, Granger, West Lafayette, Munster did pretty well here. So it's definitely kind of across the board.
Are we finding that not always the case, though, but in many of these cities that it depends on, I guess, the average family or individual income in particular city as to how well they seem to rate in this?
Yes and no. I mean, when we're looking at debt-to-income levels, obviously the higher the income, that generally helps out the overall ratio. But when we're looking at the average percent of credit used per person, credit scores, delinquencies, bankruptcies, obviously those things can be handled better than others, I think, independent of income.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Jill Gonzalez, who's an analyst. WalletHub.com has put out a new list of the number of cities across the country with the worst money management skills, and I guess how cities in Indiana seem to rate with that. Jill, in going through the information here, we've mentioned some of the important points for the methodology. How do these key points that you all used in coming up with the data seem to relate to people to try to make better sense of their own financial matters and do better at it instead of being so far in debt?
Well, I think it's really a couple of things. Obviously, it's tax season now, too, so gathering up your receipts from the past year or so, you know, really looking at your needs compared to things that you might be spending a little bit extra on that you don't necessarily need to. I mean, all of those things, I think, come to light this season more than others. So this is really the time to be looking at that, budgeting, kind of going down the list, crossing off some of those expenditures that you might not necessarily need to have. So I would say budgeting now, you know, and doing that in a realistic way. So I think looking at what you actually spend money on is really the only way to tell what you can spend money less on. So that's really key here. The other thing is, you know, finances are one thing that a lot of high schools don't necessarily teach, a lot of colleges don't necessarily teach. So becoming a little bit more active in that type of curriculum as a parent to say, listen, this is what I think our children need to know.
Do you think maybe that's a key to be able to encourage school superintendents and those who run the school boards on these districts around not only Indiana but elsewhere to maybe look into this further, to take an opportunity there to be able to beef up their civic duties and their civic curriculum?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that we hear year after year is, I wish I learned this in school, right? Mm-hmm. I know the Pythagorean theorem, but I don't know necessarily how to go about doing my taxes or how to even make a proper budget. You know, all of these things that I think we really do need to start paying a little bit more attention to.
Now, you mentioned here in closing here, Jill, that Gary turned out in, the 99th percentile of the best, or not very close to the top, and more to the bottom of the list here. Which were some of the other communities that you determined through the methodology were too close to Gary, to be sort of in the bottom?
The other places here that were in those bottom 2000s were Hammond, Hobart, Portage, East Chicago, and Merrillville, kind of in and around where Gary also ranked.
Right. Well, we can only hope for the best and try to do better, I suppose. We're talking with Jill Gonzalez, who's an analyst for WalletHub.com. WalletHub has turned out the latest list on their website of cities across the country, more than 2,500 of them, actually, that have their money management skills noted by the website, and how communities, unfortunately, like Gary and some others here in Northwest Indiana seem to rank on the list. Jill, thanks for being with us to talk about the list here. We hope to have you back on again soon.
Anytime.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.